Training to become a surgeon can feel like training for the Olympics. Then we finish and we realize we're just adults with jobs. Life after training is an entirely different landscape. You need to get to know you. What does success mean for you? What brings you joy? What's your purpose? I'm Dr. Mel Thacker, an ear, nose, and throat surgeon and coach. I'm here to help surgeons like you rediscover themselves. Welcome to Surgeons with Purpose. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. Before we get to the interview, I just want to let you know that this is an MP3 recording, so the quality isn't as good. Thank you so much for bearing with me as I figure out how to edit audio, and I'm basically trying to learn how to do like a whole different job. So I am showing you all of my imperfections, and I kind of screwed up the audio on this one, but it's still a really great interview and definitely one you're going to want to listen to. We really dive into some deep subjects, including substance abuse and what it's like to lose your license and to be investigated by the Board of Medicine, like the big, scary green monster Board of Medicine. And let me tell you, they are not nice to doctors, which is really unfortunate because I really believe that if we take care of the doctors of this country, then the patients will benefit. Caring for doctors, elevating doctors, resourcing surgeons like you is how you protect the public. And so we go into that and we talk about Brett's experience of having a group of DEA officers who are armed to the T coming to his house. Just some really scary things like that. So this is definitely one you're going to want to listen to. I am so grateful to him for sharing his story so candidly with me. These are the kinds of conversations we need to start having. They're happening. I can't even tell you the kinds of stories I hear on a day-to-day basis. The more I am growing my aperture, I am widening my vision, and I am starting to see what's actually going on. We get narrowed in our little silos. And when we start to widen our view and to see the world from the vantage point of what's actually happening in the world around us, it gives you a whole different perspective. I guess that's what they call discernment, right? And so that's what I'm trying to create for you guys. And this will add to that discernment. And I also wanted to tell you that next week, my guest will be Dr. Geeta Pensa, and I'm really excited for you to hear her story. If you haven't listened to her podcast, stop listening right now. Okay, turn this one off and go right to Doctors in Litigation, the L word, and listen to that. She talks about what it's like to go through the same malpractice suit twice. She was sued by a patient. She won that. It went to trial, which is really highly unlikely, but it did, and she won. And then she had her case thrown out and was tried all over again. And she talks about all of the lessons she learned and the person she became through it all. She really became someone who saw herself first as a victim and then became a creator. And so I really need you all to listen to her story, and then please come back and listen to her interview next week. So enough with all of the housekeeping things. And without further ado, let's get right to the interview. Today, my guest is Dr. Brett Portis. I know him very well because we were in residency together. We rotated through the county hospital, Bentaub Hospital at Baylor College of Medicine. When I was a 2, he was a 5. He graduated in 2009 and then went on to private practice after that in Houston. And he has had quite a journey that he will tell us all about. And he is now effectively retired. So thank you so much for coming on, Brett.
Thanks, Mel. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So tell our listeners a little bit about your story, because it is a little unusual to go from private practice to kind of like early retirement. So how did you land there?
All right. So I think I'll probably back up quite a bit, even before when you and I met. So I'm from Louisiana. I went to LSU as an undergrad and majored in history, of all things. Went to medical school in New Orleans and then matched at Baylor in Houston. So my wife and I were in Houston from 04 all the way through, gosh, for 15 or 16 years, I believe. But you know, I was kind of what I would describe as a people pleasing, overachieving, both medical student and resident. You know, I worked very hard, studied very hard. What drove me was kind of to be the best, you know, not the best version of myself, just the best period. And I really depended on external validation and achievements and awards and the attaboys and all that stuff. And so I mentioned that this early in my story because that becomes very important later on. But you know, I enjoyed medical school. I really enjoyed residency. I worked hard, but there was never a point where I was like, you know, counting the days till it was going to be over. But graduated in June of 2009 and then started private practice. I took 6 weeks off, I think, started that August in the Texas Medical Center at St. Luke's Hospital, which the Baylor residents used to rotate at. And built a very successful practice. In the beginning, I did, you know, almost everything. But I eventually kind of whittled out a sinus and allergy niche, you know, sinus surgery, nasal stuff, mostly, especially since, you know, you have MD Anderson across the street. I didn't feel like I was doing a service to patients doing any sort of head and neck cases when you've got, you know, a hospital like that across the street. Sure. My wife and I and family and I lived in Pearland, a suburb of Houston. And so we raised our kids there. And then, we moved from Houston to Louisiana in 2021. And it took me a while to find a job in Louisiana because we moved specifically to my wife's hometown of Lafayette. And so I didn't find a job first. We moved and then I started looking for work, but I eventually did find work in that area. So what happened probably around 2015 is I started to get, I would say, a little bit bored at work. And it was like there was nothing left to explore. There was nothing, I hate to say left to conquer, but like there was, I wasn't getting the validation that I had been getting. I loved my patients and I actually liked being in clinic more than the operating room, which I know is different from most surgeons, but I enjoyed clinic and meeting with patients more than I did operating. So I just started to, you know, look forward. I started to look at the time in clinic and when is clinic going to be over. And, I had never done that for the first 6, 7, 8 years. I mean, I always enjoyed being at work. And then simultaneously, you know, we, ended up having to deal with a personal familial mental health issue, which, was very frustrating and took a lot of time and produced a lot of confusion and frustration and the unknown. Up until this part of my life, I could always either work harder or, I mean, I'm not a super smart person by any means. I'm, you know, I have a serviceable IQ, but I'm not a genius, but usually I was smart enough to figure stuff out. And if I wasn't, I could just work really hard.
Yeah. I remember you as the golden boy of our residency. Right. I remember you winning all like the awards and the teaching awards and everyone. I remember looking up to you.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. And so really there was nothing I hadn't been able to figure out or fix or to succeed at in life.
Yeah.
But mental health does not lend itself to that. And I was just spinning my wheels and I was reading books and my wife and I tried to self-educate as much as we could. And we had every resource at our disposal. And, I was not successful at this challenge. I just didn't have the tools. And I didn't know how to deal with not being able to successfully deal with this challenge, which led to frustration, and anxiety, mm-hmm. and depression. And for the first time ever, and I mean ever, I started to have a little bit of shaking of my confidence. And so I eventually, you know, kind of fell into substance abuse because of that. And so, you know, it's kind of a story of, as you say, the golden boy of this residency program. And I had always been an overachiever my whole life, always successful at anything I did. And, I couldn't figure this thing out. And so I ended up, you know, falling into addiction because it was so uncomfortable for me to feel and experience those feelings on a daily basis. It wasn't compatible with what I considered to be myself. And so, and that lasted for, you know, 4 or 5 years and ultimately led to me losing my job in Houston and getting tangled up with the Texas Medical Board. And, once that happens, it has been a very, very long road to dig yourself out of that.
Yeah. Let me ask you, Brett, really quick. What was that like? Like, what kind of emotions were you trying to numb?
Well, I have since learned I was trying to numb powerlessness and, and just the feeling of not being able in control, the feeling of not being able to dictate my own destiny. But if I had to narrow it down, it would be powerlessness.
Yeah.
Over my own direct circumstances. It's a very scary feeling. I can feel it now that I'm talking about it, but it's not subtle. It's different from anxiety. Because it's more shame based as opposed to guilt based. And drugs would just, or alcohol would just take, they would just numb it. It would just take it away. It didn't fix it or any, by any means, but it would definitely numb it to where it was tolerable.
Where does that powerlessness live in your body?
I would say powerlessness feels like, it's like what I would imagine it would feel inside a Coke can after you shake it, but before you open it. So it's pressure right underneath your xiphoid process. But it also kind of simultaneously involves my, like the lower halves of both my legs, like a numbing, kind of like a tingling sensation. Mm-hmm. It's a very specific feeling for me.
What's the thought behind that feeling?
The thought behind powerlessness?
Yeah.
I guess the thought behind that would be that I'm not adequate, or I'm not good enough, or I don't have the knowledge or the skills to fix it, to fix things.
And before that, before this mental health crisis and this family member, you had always been able to access your brain power to fix things.
Right. Oh yeah.
And now you couldn't.
Yeah. And it was a gradual deal. You know, I would say over 4, 5, 6 years, this mental health concern became more and more evident. And then my ability to manage it became less and less, successful. And so, I'm certainly not blaming my addiction or substance abuse on any one thing at all. Certainly
right.
Not this mental health challenge, but it did give birth to this powerlessness feeling, which is, as far as I know, is the most direct trigger for a lot of my substance use.
Yeah. And isn't that so funny that before that you thought you had some sort of power, and that as long as you had power and were in control of everything, of the circumstances of the world, if you had that like grip and you could manhandle, I call it manhandling circumstances. I see surgeons doing this as well. then you would be okay. And then when it became very evident that you can't do that, you know, that's such a perfectionist thing to want to control all the germs in the world, control the circumstances for our patients so that they never have a complication. As long as they never have complications, then I'm the perfect surgeon. As long as, you know, family members never have mental health crises, then I'm the perfect brother, sister, parent, you know, whatever it is. And then when we can't control something, it's out of our control. It was never in our control in the first place. Now it's like a reckoning with reality.
Yeah. And, you know, that's, you know, when I went to treatment, I went to a 3-month residential treatment program and learned, I mean, it was a big part of it was cognitive behavioral therapy. And my counselor, who I thought was an absolute genius, he was just fantastic. But, you know, the reliance on external validation, perfectionism, and what he called the illusion of control, which is what you alluded to, when you can only control yourself and your thoughts. That's it. That's all we can control as humans, is our thoughts and our actions. Nothing else. That started to help a lot, you know.
I see that in my clients. That's one of the big concepts. It's from Byron Katie, the three businesses, our business, other people's business, and the universe's business, or if you're religious, God's business. And we just don't have jurisdiction in anybody else's business but our own. And our own business is our thoughts, our feelings, and our actions. And that's the only place we have any sort of agency or authority. Everything else we kind of have to just accept without resistance. And if we don't, we cause ourselves suffering. And then that suffering can lead, like in your case, to addiction or to numbing. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, for a lot of surgeons, it's not just addiction. It's not opioid addiction. Some people, you know, in your case it was, but in others, it could be overworking. I see overworking a lot because how we arrive at a place is how we get there. So it's like you're running on a treadmill through training. And then since you don't have the external validation, you'll just go after the money, right? Or go after the accolade. It's like climb the academic ladder until you hit the brick wall and you're like the chair of a department and you're like, well, now what? So it's however you numb out, social media, scrolling, Netflixing and chilling, food, whatever your drug of choice is, so to speak, you overconsume it to fill that void.
Yeah. Yeah. I learned to call it, you know, it's any mood altering substance or behavior. So, right. You know, gambling or sex or work or any of a number of things, not just substance use specifically, but yeah.
Yeah. So how did you navigate the time when you were in addiction and also trying to show up to work and for your family and be a normal human in the world?
I mean, I can only give you my perspective. Because I hate to say that I managed pretty well. I managed professional life very well.
Yeah.
In fact, professional life was probably easier, than it ever had been. And again, I had been working already for, you know, at least 7 years. So I was very comfortable doing what I was doing.
Yeah. You were bored.
Right.
At it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mentioned that. So professionally, it was not an issue. Personally, it was really only, I mean, really my wife was the only one that could tell that something was off. And it was a couple years until, you know, I was able to be honest with her about it. And generally with addicts and alcoholics, you know, we're taught that a lot more people know than we think know. Mm-hmm. So that's why I say from my perspective, I'd managed very well.
Right.
Who knows how many people had suspicions of an issue, but I will say my work performance did not suffer, mm-hmm. which made it more difficult.
Yeah. You
know, that I wasn't having any natural consequences of it for a long time.
Yeah. And that shows how well-trained we are and how good we are at this job that we can have a simultaneous addiction and take really good care of people.
Right.
Show up and be really good at what we're doing. It makes you wonder how many rat cortices there are out there. And my guess is there's a lot.
Well, and you know, one thing I heard it was found out at work what I was doing. I was using substances, opiates. I lost my job. I went to rehab. The Texas Medical Board suspended my license and everything. And but I didn't really tell anyone about this. Family, friends. So very few people knew. And I did tell my really good friends back home in Louisiana, you know, my old friends from grade school and high school. And almost every one of them said, man, you're the last person I would have thought would have had a problem like that.
Really? You're the last person I would have thought if anybody asked me from residency. I'd been like, no way, not Brett.
Yeah. And so, and that's what I thought about myself. I was in denial about me being an addict for a long time because of what I had accomplished my whole life. But I found out in rehab that my kind of distinct character defects and strengths and weaknesses is a perfect setup for substance abuse. Namely perfectionism and, you know, depending on external validation. Those two in particular, and trying to control everything.
Yeah.
Those three is a recipe for disaster because, you know, you might get a long way with those three and you might be successful for a long time, but it's going to catch up to most people at some point. And you better have a coping mechanism when that happens, which I did not.
Yeah. Or even understand it and maybe even normalize it or humanize it where it's like, oh, I understand what's happening here. Like I'm a perfectionist who relies on external validation and I feel like I need to manhandle the world and control the circumstances. Clearly that is a setup for suffering. How am I going to manage that? And I'm not alone. Like this is not unique to me. I'm just a human with these characteristics in a very unpredictable world.
Yeah. And, you know, I will say the state medical boards and especially the Texas Medical Board, they are unforgiving institutions.
Yeah. Like and when they found you out and like, what do they do? Send you a letter, give you a call?
Well, no, when they found me out, they got in contact with the DEA and, okay. I had four armed DEA officers knock at my front door on a Thursday afternoon. Because I guess they thought I was some sort of a drug kingpin or something. I don't know. I lived in the suburbs.
So they came to Pearland while your family's there?
Well, my kids were at school. My wife was shopping.
Okay, so you're home alone and they come.
Yeah.
What was your thought?
Well, I was scared. That's scary.
That is really scary. I'd be terrified.
We're talking about like, hey, I'm not a gun person, but you know, what appeared to be semi-automatic weapons and vests, bulletproof vests. And I'm like, man, I think y'all can tone it down just a little bit here. You know, come on in. What's going on? So no, they're not subtle about things like that. And I don't want to get off on a tangent about, you know, the medical board, but my point in saying that is once you get into substance abuse, mental health, and the state boards find out about it and know about it, it's a long, unforgiving road to get out from underneath it.
Yeah.
That's what I'll say.
You don't have a leg to stand on.
Right.
You as guilty and dangerous.
Well, yeah, you're guilty and dangerous. The attitude is that you should be forever grateful that we're even giving you a chance to come back.
Wow.
And that expectation of unending gratitude is permanent. That never goes away.
Did you ever feel any gratitude towards them?
I did not. No. And I will be the first to tell you that if I didn't mess up, I would have never had a meeting with the Texas Medical Board. If I hadn't developed an addiction, you know, it's my fault that this all came down on me. But two things can be true at the same time. It can be my fault that all this stuff happened, but I can also have an expectation to be treated fairly.
You're touching on something that is so important, and you're right. Two things can be true. The system can be very bad for us. It can be very abusive. Okay. We are in an abusive relationship with an abusive system, and we are also abusing ourselves. Like, the abuse comes from both. Isn't that just so fascinating?
Yeah. And I don't think most people realize that.
Yeah.
I certainly didn't. But so I was actually out of work for 4 years between 2019 and 2023. And during that time, I got really interested in addiction medicine and recovery, cognitive behavioral therapy with recovery, and did a lot of reading about it. And, you know, briefly contemplated, you know, being an addiction counselor for a while, decided against that.
Why did you decide against that?
Because even though I'm working on kind of divorcing patient outcomes from how I feel about myself, it's a journey, and numbers aren't good in that line of work.
It's true. Yeah.
So I'm not sure I want to choose something knowing that it's an almost direct conflict with one of my character defects.
You know, it's so interesting you call that a character defect. I don't think it is. It just is, right? And I wonder, where did the people pleasing, the external validation, and the need to control the world come from? Because they're you and you're amazing.
Right.
So they're not defects.
Right. Yeah. Somewhere along the lines, I guess deep down, I don't feel like I'm truly good enough. And so I'm just endlessly trying to prove to myself and others that I am.
Do you think you're good enough now?
Yes, I do.
What is that like?
It's different. I mean, it's very freeing. I mean, once you learn, and again, I haven't learned this. I don't want to talk about it like it's past tense. It's a daily struggle, but especially with external validation, once you learn that your self-worth, you have that no matter what, and what other people think of you don't matter. And even if it did matter, you can't control it anyway. Once I was able to release that, it's very freeing. And, you know, some things that used to wind me up don't anymore, you know, like watching sports on TV. It's just, I enjoy it, but I don't get wound up about it. In life in general, you know, if I can't control it, sometimes I slip up, but if I can't control it and it's not my actions or my thoughts or my feelings, then I just accept it.
Yeah. So if you didn't want to do addiction medicine, how did you pivot? How did you decide what you're going to do with your life?
Well, that's a good question, Mel. So I guess this was about a little over a year ago. I had commented on a couple of your Facebook posts between October and November, about coaching and some about cognitive behavioral therapy, but basically I was using language from recovery. I was using recovery language. And it seemed like you recognized at least some of the themes. And so you and I started talking, and you introduced me to coaching, you know, life coaching. And of course you're working with surgeons. And so that's when I started to think, wow, what an unbelievable opportunity that has almost literally come out of nowhere, out of thin air. Mm-hmm. Because I can use my expertise as a surgeon and doctor, my own experience as a surgeon and doctor who suffered through addiction and recovery, and my desire to kind of give back to my community. It all rolls into a perfect little package that is coaching. So, I have to give you the credit for that, Mel.
Yeah. And how do you feel about becoming a coach?
Yeah, it's exciting. You know, I'll use the word passion because it's been a while. You know, I did go back to work in 2023. And although I liked it and enjoyed it, it was pretty obvious that I did not love it anymore. And at least for me, I didn't feel like I could provide the kind of care to my patients that I feel like they deserve if I didn't love what I was doing. And so leaving clinical practice was one big factor. And I just haven't felt passionate about something professionally in a long time, until this whole coaching thing came about. And as you know, my idea at this point is to get involved with coaching physicians who are experiencing symptoms of burnout, whether that includes substance use or not. But I'm extremely excited about it. And it diverges from what my personality would normally kind of consider a good opportunity. Usually I like things that are definite with perfect paths and steps along the way and everything. And it might be hard, but at least I know exactly what to do and that I will get to this certain place. But that's not the case with this. And I've learned to kind of embrace it. It's fun, really. You know, I mean, for someone who's hated change my whole life, it's a little scary, but it's fun. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's so funny that you're speaking exactly to what I hear a lot, where coaching is it's a wild west. It's not regulated. You know, it's an unregulated industry. Anybody can call themselves a coach. I mean, you are in Martha Beck's training program, which I think is incredible. And I think you'll come out and be just an absolutely phenomenal coach being trained by her in that program. But when we go through surgical training, it's like, you decide you're going to be a surgeon at age whatever. And then it's like, oh, here's this nice little packaged thing. You go to college, you go to medical school, you go to residency. And it's like, and you know for sure what you're going to get at the end versus driving in the dark is what it's like when you become like an entrepreneur or a solopreneur is what you are basically when you first start and you don't have employees. And then there has to be some courage. And I think of it, Martha Beck talks about like jumping off of a high dive. And if you're going to jump off of a high dive on a really hot day and you're jumping into crystal clear water, there's going to be fear. You know, I remember the first time I jumped off of a high dive and I was afraid, but I was like, I'm going to do it anyway because it's going to feel so refreshing. And so you just take the leap. But if you're going to jump into like toxic sludge, you shouldn't jump. There'll still be fear, but you get off and you get off the high dive. You don't actually jump into that substance, into like nuclear waste. So it's when you notice that something gives you passion or it's going to create an impact or it fascinates you, like it gives you attention without effort, that tells you like, okay, I'm going to be jumping into crystal clear water. And yeah, I will have fear, but I can do it with the fear. Because I don't know for you yet, but for me, like every single day I'll be leaving my practice at the end of the year. And every single day I'm like, okay, my brain harasses me. That fear is there. And I bring that fear with me everywhere. And it's almost like a child. I'm the parent and I'm like, yes, honey, I know. I know it's certain. I know we don't get it all packaged and beautiful and you have no clue where you're going, but you have the vision. And as long as you have the vision and you have the fascination and you love it and it's fun, you will create it. And I have to continuously kind of reparent myself in that way.
Yeah. And then another factor, everything you said was true. And then another factor that makes it even more likely to be successful is that there is a huge need for it.
Huge need. Huge need.
For what I'm envisioning doing and from what you are already doing. I mean, doctors are people too, but we're an extremely stubborn, self-reliant, you know, group of people who don't like to ask for help, but who are suffering.
Yeah.
And I think the suffering, whether it be from burnout or whether it be from performance anxiety or whatnot, it's not going to get better anytime soon with the way government and insurance companies and physicians and how that dance goes. It's going to get worse before it gets better. That's for sure.
Yeah, no, I think we're at like a point of reckoning where there's going to be a cultural shift. I mean, I'm realizing that everything I talk about is in complete opposition, and everything you learn in coaching is in complete opposition to what we learn when we go through training. It's like, oh, all humans are equal. Wait, no, there's a vertical hierarchy. If you come in as an intern, you're a lesser being than you are as a chief, who's a lesser being of the attending. And we're basically saying that's all bullshit. That is not actually true. There's so many things like vulnerability, the whole idea of a front stage and a backstage self. So we say, okay, you show up as a front stage version, and that's the big doctor who's way up here. And the patient is way down low. And there's this huge disconnection, like paternalistic type, you know, society. And you have to put on that facade. You have to pretend, even if you had a bad day, you cannot be vulnerable. You cannot be transparent, but open or honest. And I'm saying, no, drop it. Close the gap between the front stage and the backstage self, and be totally vulnerable with your patients, and you will develop a closer relationship and you'll build trust with them. And so it's like all these differing, contradicting messages. So I think it'll be very slow going, like you said, but we're going to cause more suffering the more we perpetuate the old way, like the vertical hierarchies and the pretending and the abuse and the you have to do it on your own and the pluralistic ignorance where everyone thinks they're the only one. And so they're quiet about it when everybody around them is suffering in silence.
Yeah. And, you know, I've done some work trying to look for opportunities or avenues for me to kind of get my story out there to other physicians, and specifically to have some sort of a platform where physicians who are secretly battling substance abuse or alcoholism can ask me questions, because very, 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 very few physicians who do have addiction or alcohol problems tell anyone about it, even when they're into successful recovery. And so as a doctor, if you're struggling with this, you don't know who to turn to. You don't know who to tell. You don't know who to trust. And so, it would be nice to have some sort of a platform where people could ask me questions about, not just about substance use or abuse or alcoholism, but, you know, do's and don'ts with dealing with the board and, yes. you know, where and how to get treatment. And because I made a lot of mistakes, along the way. And I would love to be able to, you know, give some of my brethren some of the knowledge that I've developed the hard way.
Yeah. What is the biggest mistake you think you made along the way?
In terms of navigating the board?
Yeah.
And okay, that specifically. I guess the biggest mistake would be to trust that they have your best interest or health at heart.
Mm.
And I don't blame them either.
Right.
You know,
they're,
I mean,
supposed to protect the public.
That's right. Their responsibility is to protect the public. And I totally respect that. And I also am well aware of the numbers. You know, there's not that many employees at these institutions, and there's a lot of people that they're looking out for. But again, I go back to the same, what I had mentioned earlier, that two things can be true. You can protect the public, and you can also treat people humanely.
I would argue that if you protect the physicians, you are protecting the public. I mean, there's a physician shortage. Healthy physicians lead to healthy patients. When we are well-resourced, we can resource and help our patients. So the more we vilify the person like who's going through some sort of crisis, as every human does in their life, we're all going to have a mental health issue. We're all going to have some sort of circumstances that are going to be overwhelming for us, and we're going to seek comfort in some way, shape, or form. Nobody goes through life as an emotionless robot. And so when that inevitably happens to a physician, can you imagine if like a board was like, ooh, let me come and like resource you and take care of you so that you can take care of your patients. And that is us protecting the public. Again, you know, like complete contradiction to the way that it is currently, but I think that needs to change.
Yeah. Yeah. And I agree with you about the culture of residency training. It's, you know, I'll use the term outdated.
Yeah.
I don't really know how it used to be in the 50s, 60s, 70s. I know I've heard stories. But not only is it abuse and inappropriate, but it's just not effective. You know, it would be different if it was really effective, but you had to put up with this or that, but that's not the case. So, yeah, I think a change needs to happen, and it's going to be for the better when it does.
Yeah, it's not useful. Like people like you and I who go into this profession and we are like gung ho and willing, we want to learn, we want to help patients, we want to do the surgeries. We can take care of those people and not put them through like militaristic cult like things in order to show them or somehow like form them so that they're ready. I would even say that like when we put fear on people, we actually shrink their cognitive capacity versus like compassion and curiosity and all of these like wonderful brain opening emotions, I think would be so much more useful. And I think that we do well. Surgeons do a good job despite, not because of the training that they go through.
Yeah. And I think, you know, people say, you know, people are motivated by different things. And I'll speak for myself. But again, physicians, surgeons, personalities are fairly similar, certainly more similar than we are different.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think for me, fear is a good motivator when I'm preparing for something. But when it comes to actually doing something, fear works against me, you know, and support and encouragement is more motivating when it comes to actually doing it. But fear is fairly effective for me when it comes to preparing. You know, you don't want to show up at morning report unprepared.
No, definitely not. Fear works in the short term. And I think that's why fear is so beautiful. You know, it works so well for residency programs because it does work in short term, but long term, it ends up backfiring. And that's why we have this physician mental health crisis. But we have people like you to like help us. Thank goodness. Isn't that amazing that from the ashes or from all of the mess, something beautiful can grow from it and you can have such a big impact?
Yeah, that's the goal. And I think, you know, you and I, at being where we trained, we were able to work under and be trained under someone who modeled motivating through support and motivating through I don't want to say love, but fear was not a part of his teaching toolbox. Talking about Dr. Donovan. And so
Dr. Donovan, you know, is like the epitome of a humble leader.
Yeah, he was one of those people where you would do anything so you wouldn't feel like you disappointed him.
Yes.
You know, you weren't afraid of him.
No way.
You just kind of wanted him to, you know, to be proud of the job you did, because he demonstrated that too. That's how he lived his life, at least professionally.
Yeah, he embodied it. WWD, so, right? What would Donovan do?
Right. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You stay in contact with him?
No. No. I did for a few years. While I was in Houston, I did. But no, not recently.
Okay. Well, if there are any physicians that are listening who are dealing with addiction or suffering silently with any sort of mental health issues, what would be your message for them?
Well, my message would be to get help, you know, find someone you trust, and try to get help, which is easier said than done, you know, even with financial resources and professional resources, it's not easy to find help, so to speak. But don't suffer in silence any longer. That would be my first message. There's light at the end of the tunnel, you know?
Yeah. And if they want to work with you or get a hold of you, how do they do that?
Well, as you said, you know, I'm still getting certified. I'm still being trained. So I'll have to get back to you with a website and email.
What about Instagram? Any Instagram?
Brett.Cordes, Brett.Cordes. And then there'll be websites and emails and newsletters and other things to follow.
Yeah. In the future. Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Well, awesome. Well, thank you. Thanks so much.
All right. Do we have time for one more thing? Are we still recording?
Yeah.
Okay. I want to tell the listeners, your listeners, one story.
Yes.
About you.
Okay.
So we were doing, in training, I was a fifth year resident. Mel was a two, right? So that's kind of the widest gap in knowledge and skill that you can get in residency. And it's one of the better rotations. It's good for the five, especially if you like to teach, because you learn when you teach, you know, so it's good for the five and it's phenomenal for the two because you're getting to operate with a chief resident without other residents or medical students. So it's a mutually beneficial team. And so we're together for 3 months, you know, working 80 hours a week. So you get to know people pretty well. And so I didn't really know Mel at all when she started. And about, it was the second week of January. Martin Luther King Day was coming up and the Houston Marathon, is run over that weekend. And it was like the marathon's on a Sunday and it was like a Thursday or Friday. And Mel told me, yeah, I think maybe I'll go run the marathon. And I was like, you know, like it's a 5K, like it's a church 5K or something. And I was like, okay, have you been trained? No, but I've won marathon. I think I'll go do it. And she did. She showed up on Tuesday and she was walking like she was trying to hold a bowling ball between her legs. But I mean, she ran it and finished it. And I was like, good Lord, who runs a marathon and finishes it without training? That was one of my first, you know, kind of direct introductions to who Mel is.
So funny. I won't do that anymore. Like my 44-year-old body wouldn't let me.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Right.
But when I was in my twenties, thirties, oh, I could easily do it.
Unbelievable.
Well, it was so good to talk to you, Brett. Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me again.
Thank you all for listening. Brett really is the salt of the earth kind of a guy. And I was shocked when I heard that he had fallen into addiction. Of all the people that I knew in residency, he was the last person I thought would have fallen into addiction. And so please know that if you are struggling with substance abuse, you are not alone, and please find help. And recognize that we can't judge a book by its cover. We don't know what's going on underneath the surface. Like, we're really just seeing the tip of the iceberg when we interact with each other, especially in this profession where we're all just pretending and putting forth like this perfectionist front, like this good doctor, martyr, people-pleasing, overachieving front. When inside, we may be feeling something completely different. And the more there is a gap between our front stage and our backstage self, the more our suffering. And humans can only tolerate suffering for so long. So please, if you are suffering, if you are numbing out with substances, get help. And you can reach Brett at the.burnoutdoc on Instagram, or you can email him at theburnoutdoc@gmail.com. That's theburnoutdoc@gmail.com. Thanks again for listening, and make sure you come back here next week to talk all about what it's like to get tried for the same case twice with Dr. Gita Pensa. Hey, when you got into surgery, when you were bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, you told yourself a story that it was going to be amazing, and it's not. That's okay. If you want to learn how to navigate the landscape of life after training, you are in luck. I have created a course just for you. It's called Empowered Surgeons Curriculum. It gives you everything you need to learn that you didn't learn in training about how to be a human in the world of surgery. All you have to do is go to courses.melthackercoaching.com/courses/empowered surgeon, or click the link in the show notes. See you inside the course.